You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and special welcome. We have four news stations joining us this week. KBKE in North Manchester, Indiana. KPFT in Houston, Texas. 100,000-watt station that has the distinction of being the only radio station in America to be bombed off the air twice in the same year, actually, 1970. KXCR in Florence, Oregon, and Cheshire TV in Keene, New Hampshire. The entire cable system is now carrying our show simulcast as television. So welcome to all of you listening through these new outlets. It being Friday, our first hour every Friday is Senator Bernie Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders, who I think of as America's senator, although I lived in Vermont. I know how much the people of Vermont love this guy. Senator Sanders, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. You've got a lot on your plate. What's up?
We do. I'm calling you from Philadelphia. That's why it went on the screen. I'm in the airport in Philadelphia, where I just spoke to, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 members of the National Association of Letter Carriers. These are the men and women who deliver our mail. And it's a great, great group of people, and they're fighting for their lives. So it's just fun to be with them. As I think we have discussed on this program many, many times, there is an effort by the Koch brothers and the other right-wing folks in Congress to move toward the privatization of virtually every agency and every program which benefits the middle class of working families of this country, so they can give even more tax breaks to large corporations and wealthy people. And right in the middle of that attack is the Postal Service, and they're getting hammered every day. You have people like Darrell Issa in the House essentially wanting to do away with all of the regulatory regulations and come up with a control board, give all power to a control board so they can shut down post offices all over America, shut down processing plants, slow down mail delivery service, privatize large elements of the Postal Service. And these guys have been fighting back furiously and with some success. So while we haven't won at all, we have prevented the worst of what ICER and others want to do. And we have legislation in which would strengthen the Postal Service, give them more capability to provide services so they can make more money. Right now, if you want to get a gift wrap by the Postal Service, it's against the law for them to do that. You can't even get a document copied at the Postal Service against the law. You can't get a hunting license, a fishing license against the law. You can't have mail or you can't have wine or beer delivered through the Postal Service against the law. So a whole lot of stuff that the Postal Service can be doing to bring in new revenue. But here's the funny point. When you talk about the Postal Service, people don't know this, but in terms of operating profits, the Postal Service is doing reasonably well. From October of 2012 to today, they've made over $1 billion in operating profits. And the problem that they're dealing with, not everybody knows this, is under Bush, they were hit with his mandate of coming up with $5.5 billion for future health retiree benefits. Every year they have to put $5.5 billion into an account, which now is $47 billion. If we just eliminate that burden, which no other agency of government has, which no other private corporation comes anywhere close to, Postal Service will be making money. And we can preserve the jobs that some people want to cut. So that, to me, is a very important issue. You know, at a time when the middle class is shrinking and we don't have decent union-paying jobs, we got to preserve those jobs. So that's one area we're working hard on. The second area, which I have been just kind of working very, very hard on as the chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee, is to make sure that we pass legislation which addresses the significant, very significant needs facing the veterans community. And Tom, if there's one thing that I have learned in the last year and a half since I've been chairman of the committee, is what the cost of war is about. Yeah. And it is not pretty. And, you know, we lost 6,700 men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's a tragedy. And then you think about what happens to their wives and their kids, how we make sure that those folks can get their lives rebuilt. Not easy. We are now dealing with some 500,000 men and women who came home from Iraq and Afghanistan with traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder. And those are really tough problems to deal with. And these guys and women, they are struggling. On any given day, today, at the Veterans Administration, some 49,000 people are getting outpatient mental health treatment. 49,000 every single day. So the issue that we're dealing with right now is, given the long waiting periods that we've seen in hospitals around the country, VA hospitals, what we want to do on an emergency basis is make sure that no veteran has to wait long periods to get in to see a doctor. So we are trying to fight for money to allow veterans to be able to get private care if they need it, community health center care if they need it, so they get care when they need it. But long term, we have to rebuild the VA and make sure there are the numbers of doctors and nurses, nurse practitioners and medical personnel and space that the VA needs, which they do not have right now. So we're in the midst of some very, very intense negotiations. The clock is ticking. This Congress is going to get out next week for the August break, and I want to see this thing done. So we've been working very hard with the House to see if we can come up with a compromise agreement. We're not there yet, and I hope we can be there in a couple of days. I hope very much that we can. But it is, I just hope everybody appreciates the sacrifices, not only the veterans, but that their families have made. You know, when somebody comes back from war, either with PTSD, TBI, or without legs, without arms, without eyesight, it's a horrendous, it's something, you know, that the veteran himself has to deal with. But it's also the wives, the kids, and we have got to be appreciative of that. And what I have said over and over again, if people are not prepared to put the necessary amounts of money into taking care of those people who put their lives on the line to defend this country, then you don't send them off to war in the first place. That's the cost of war. You know, when we talk about the cost of war, we talk about planes and missiles and tanks and guns, and that's fine. But the men and women who are fighting those wars, they're part of the cost of war. When they come home, they deserve the best possible care. So that's an issue we are working very, very hard on. When we talk about funding issues, we are also talking about, corporate America doing everything that it can to avoid paying its fair share of taxes. If you look at the percentage of revenue coming into the federal government from corporate America today, it is substantially less than it was 50 years ago. They're paying a smaller and smaller percentage of the tax burden. You have one out of four corporations paying nothing in taxes. We are losing about $100 billion every year because many of these profitable corporations are stashing their money in tax havens in the Cayman Islands and in Bermuda and elsewhere. And now we have this new business of inversion. See, these guys spend huge amounts of money trying to figure out. Their goal is, how do I avoid paying taxes? How do I avoid paying taxes? So now their new scam is, in addition to, you know, putting their money in the Cayman Island, what they want to do now is merge, and you have Walgreens doing that, AbbVie, large drug company doing that. What they want to do now is merge with companies in Ireland or UK, so they have their headquarters in those countries, and they can take advantage of all the tax breaks that those countries have, so they get even more tax breaks. So these, you know, these companies which have made their wealth here in the United States of America are now turning their back on the people of this country, going abroad so they can cut their taxes. And when that happens, the deficit goes up, and we have less resources available to protect low and moderate income families. So we've got to fight that as well.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more, with your questions, actually, for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website. It's sanders.senate.gov, and you can track him down quite easily on Facebook as well, and Twitter.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sanders.senate.gov, .gov, G-O-V, plus Facebook and Twitter and, you know, all the usual places. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Ralph in Grand Isle, Nebraska, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Senator. Tom, Senator, I have a problem here in Grand Island. We have a VA home and a VA hospital here in Grand Island, and they are now decided to build a new VA home 50 miles west of us in another town where there's no VA hospital. They're going to move these people over there, and they're going to make two trips a day back and forth from Kearney, Nebraska to Grand Island. And we've tried to stop this, but the governor picked a spot to be built, and we can't do anything about it. And they said if the government gets the money to this to do this, then we can't stop them at all. Could you help us get, look into this and make sure it's not the – I don't know what to say. Sounds like the place going to get rich on this. Could you help us?
Well, let me understand this. Is this a community-based outreach clinic, or is this a nursing home?
This is a VA home that's been here in Grand Island for – I know for 75 years because that's how old I am.
It's a nursing
home. 1 mile from the VA hospital. And they're trying to build a new VA home for these people 50 miles west of here where there's no VA home or no VA hospital.
Okay, let me suggest that you call the Senate veterans. I would call up your senators to begin with, but you can also call up the Senate Veterans Committee. You may not get a response from us for a little while because we're working on a very important piece of legislation, but we will look into it. Give us a ring in Washington.
And you said that's a Senate what?
Senate Veterans Affairs Committee.
Veterans Affairs Committee.
Right. If you call, I can give you a phone number here, Ralph. If you call the switchboard for Congress, they will connect you. This will get you to any senator's office and any committee's office. It's 202.
Switchboard for Congress.
Yeah.
Okay, sir. I thank you very much. I hope you can help us because this sounds crooked to me.
Okay, Ralph.
Okay, Ralph, here's a phone number for you. Are you still there?
Yes, sir.
The phone number is 202-225-3121. That's the congressional switchboard, and just ask for that.
3121.
Okay.
What was the first three letters?
202-225-3121.
225-3121.
Correct.
Thank you very much for your help.
Okay, good luck. Good luck, Ralph. Steve in Glendale, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. I used to live there. I should know how to say it. Hey, Steve, what's up? You're on with Bernie.
Well, I wanted to ask Mr. Sanders if he could block the funding for Congressman DeFazio's fuel reduction treatment programs, which are basically preemptive burning and commercial logging, and if he could stand against Congressman or Senator Wyden's forestry bill, which it will turn our salmon restoration projects backwards 30 years.
Bernie, we got about 30 seconds.
Well, Steve, I apologize. I'm just not familiar with those. It's something that we can take a look at, but I would not be telling you the truth if I was familiar with those pieces of legislation. There are thousands of bills out there, and I'm just not familiar with that one, so I apologize, but it's something we can take a look at.
Yeah, and this has to do with Oregon, and Congressman DeFazio is a congressman from Oregon, and Wyden is the senator, so he would probably be advised taking it up with them, don't you think?
Right.
So, okay, we will be back. We're going to hit a break in about 3 seconds. Yep, there it is. Okay, we will be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls on our Anything Goes Friday program, our national town hall meeting. Senator Bernie Sanders. Stick with me. The hour. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls for the rest of the hour. Do you have to leave a few minutes early, Senator?
I may have to leave to catch a plane, yeah.
Okay, so just let me know, okay? And we'll do that. So let's see here. Cherish in Flushing, New York. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. First, just wanted to say I love your work and following you for the past couple of years. And as a fellow New Yorker, excellent work. My question is, so with money in politics, it's an issue that both sides can agree on. So my question is, with antitrust laws that have been passed, such as the Sherman Antitrust Act in the 20th century, what's stopping Congress from breaking up a lot of these companies that you see across almost every industry? I mean, you have a company like AT&T that was broken up and then just essentially reformed almost back to the monolithic state that it was back in the 80s.
Very good question. And the answer is, right now, in the House of Representatives, you have leadership there which, by and large, with very few exceptions, is working day and night to protect the interests of the wealthy and the largest corporations in America. And the issue that you have raised is one Tom talks about a whole lot, but we don't talk about enough in America. You know, I often talk about the issue of distribution of wealth where and income, where the rich are getting richer and everybody else is getting poorer, and that's enormously important. But we don't quite talk about enough is the concentration of ownership that exists in one sector of our economy after another, whether it is financial services, whether it is agriculture, whether it is communications, or whatever. And what we see in many instances is fewer and fewer large entities controlling that entire sector. One area that we have focused on is the issue of Wall Street. And I think many listeners would be shocked to know that we bailed out Wall Street in 2009 because they were quote unquote too big to fail. And I voted against that legislation, but the theory was that if you let Wall Street go down, the entire economy would sink with it. And that was why they had to be bailed out, because they were too big to fail. Well, of the six largest financial institutions that were bailed out, I believe five of them today are larger than they were before we bailed them out. And these huge financial institutions have assets equivalent to over 60% of the GDP of this country. They write something like half of the mortgages in America and two-thirds of the credit cards. So these just in one area, what the power of a handful of financial institutions over our economy is just extraordinary. And I would tell you that my view is they got to break them up. We have to break them up if you want to see any degree of serious competition within the financial service industry. And that is true in area after area. And you ask why that has not taken place. Well, the answer has everything to do with the first point you made, and that's money in politics. These guys spend combined hundreds of millions of dollars to make sure that corporate profits soar, their corporations pay less in taxes, the corporations are able to ship their jobs to China or to Mexico, and they will resist any effort to break them up. But I think, you know, we need, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was a good Republican president in the early part of the 20th century. And he and William Howard Taft, another good Republican, were busy breaking up the major corporate entities of their time. And I think it's time we did the same in the year 2014.
David in Loves Park, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, guys. At first, I just want to say I met you in Goose Lake, Iowa, a couple months ago, Senator. So thank you for that. But I wanted to give a shout out real quick. And I have a question about the post office. The local union, the NALC 245, was actually in Philly with you this morning or when you spoke to them. So I wanted to give that shout out. But my question is, as far as Saturday delivery is concerned, is there any update on that being saved, or is there like a an amendment?
David, yes, there is an amendment. There has been for many years an amendment in the appropriations bill, which a rider which keeps getting passed, which says that the Saturday mail delivery will continue. Now, the Postal Service wants to eliminate it. The Republicans in the House, at least the leadership, wants to eliminate it. But we are fighting back, and so far they have not succeeded. We're going to continue to fight back. My view is that we need a strong Postal Service. As I mentioned earlier, in fact, in the last year, if you exclude this horrendous and onerous funding for future health retiree benefits, they will be making money. They're making money right now. So we're going to fight to preserve Saturday mail delivery. The American people need that, and we need it if we're going to maintain a strong and effective Postal Service.
Jim in Lockport, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, once again, a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
My big question is, as a son of a World War II veteran, I've always watched my father vote, and even if the guy he voted for didn't make it in there, the vets always got behind the new president. Now, with all this rhetoric we get from the right hand or the right wing about the president being weak, do they realize how they make our country look when they try to knock a law down 50 times or the constant badgering of the president being weak. Do you think, is there any way we could curb that?
That's a great question, Jim. And, I sometimes rack my brain and I'm in the middle of this every single day being in the Congress and I see what goes on and I know the players. And I sometimes just try to take a deep breath and move my mind back and say, what's going on? Why do these people want to do it? And I think I can't come up with any better conclusion than it's just simply power. That, they want to destroy Obama in order to gain power. If it means destroying, setting back the United States of America in so many ways, they are prepared to do that.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And you can very easily track him down on Facebook and Twitter. It's Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your questions in our national town hall meeting. And Josh in Algona, Iowa. Josh, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Senator Sanders. It's an absolute pleasure to talk with you. The Republicans love to talk about secure the border first. And, Senator, they never, ever tell us what that means. You know, to me, what that means is you're going to put 100,000 troops down there on the border indefinitely and implode the military budget, cost of trillions of dollars. So my question would be to the Republicans and to you, if they want to do something like that, is our southern border with Mexico more important than our border with South Korea, NATO's border with Russia, or our presence in the Middle East? You know?
Well, that's a good point, Josh. I mean, I think we do need a secure border. I think we have made progress in recent years. I think we're dealing right now with an issue that is not a quote-unquote border issue, and it's not a quote-unquote immigration issue. The issue that we're dealing with is a real human tragedy and a refugee issue of people coming from Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, where children are being subjected to just horrendous, horrendous violence. This is a moral issue. How do we deal with that in a sensible way? But to exploit that issue politically, when you have kids, little children, mothers who are running for their lives, putting their lives at risk to get out of towns which are controlled by violent gangs, to politicize that issue, which the Republicans are doing, is just objectionable in the strongest way.
Michelle in Timberlake, North Carolina. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Thank you for taking my call. What I'd like to know is what can the average person do to help with changing the law of the Postal Service, having to fund those retirees?
Well, Michelle, I think the average person has got to make sure that his or her senator or member of the House knows how strongly we feel about protecting the Postal Service, protecting the 500,000 jobs that are in the Postal Service, how strongly we feel about the role that the Postal Service plays in our entire economy. If we do not have a good mail system where mail and packages are not delivered in a timely manner, it impacts the entire economy. And what the attacks against the Postal Service are about, it's a political attack. Right now, actually, and I think people know this, the government does not subsidize the Postal Service. Their money comes from the work that they do, the services they provide. And in fact, it ends up costing us less than in other countries to get the service that we're getting right now. So I think what we have to understand, and people have got to understand, Michelle, is that this is a political attack. It's a political attack. to try to destroy the Postal Service, which is not any different than the kind of attacks that I have seen to try to destroy Social Security a few years ago. Social Security is going broke. We need to privatize it. Well, guess what? Social Security is not going broke. And if you lift the cap on taxable income, Social Security will be there, strong and vibrant for the next 40, 50 years. Medicare is not going broke. Medicare is not going broke. It is the attack from the right wing against any governmental agency which provides goods and services to the American people and which pays workers a decent wage. And that's the message, Michelle, that we've got to get out. So the goal is now to get rid of this onerous pre-retirement mandate. If we do that, the Postal Service makes money.
Sean in Greensboro, North Carolina. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Mr. Sanders. Senator Sanders, sorry. I have a question about student loans. Has anything really been done, or is anything going to be done for private student loans and the for-profit schools that have really been putting a lot of students into a lot of debt? I graduated from a for-profit, and they've put me in a tremendous amount of debt, and the private student loan companies don't really seem to try to do anything to help out the tons of students who are in a lot of trouble and are drowning from all of this. You know if anything's actually...
Sure. Yes, the answer is absolutely yes, because I'm on the committee that does that, and I know there have been many, many hearings, and I've attended some of them. I think what Sean is talking about, you have, you know, some for-profit universities do a reasonable job, so I don't want to condemn all of them, but there are some who are very, very clear that their goal is not educating students. It's not making sure that students can go out and into the economy and get decent paying jobs. What they do is manipulate students, take advantage of federal programs like the Pell Grant program to make as much money as they possibly can. They false advertise, they come on in here, we'll do this and that for you, which they don't do, and students end up leaving with no degree or with a degree that doesn't mean anything and can't get them a job, and they end up deeply, deeply in debt. So, Sean, the answer is, like everything else, some of us are trying to deal with that issue. We've had a number of hearings. I think there's legislation out there. But right now, taking on any for-profit institution, whether it's Wall Street or whether it's for-profit schools of higher education, is not easy with Republicans defending those institutions. The other thing that we're trying to do very hard is we understand. I've held meetings with young people in the state of Vermont. I've talked to a doctor, a young doctor, who graduated medical school with $300,000 in debt. Many young people graduating $50,000, $60,000 in debt from colleges. And this is totally absurd. It is absurd for the young people. It is absurd for our economy. We have got to create a situation where people, regardless of income, can go to college, get the education they need, regardless of the income of their family, and not saddle them with this deep debt. And we're trying to deal with that as well. So the answer is yes. Some of us are trying to deal with these issues, lower interest rates on debt, make college more affordable. But like everything else, we have opposition from the right-wing Republicans.
Corey in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, on the air with Senator Sanders.
Corey? Tom has heard this question before, but what authority gives the president the power to drone kill an American without trial or any form of due process, as in the case of Anwar al-Awlaki? And how is that even constitutional?
Well,
and if it's not constitutional, why isn't your oath to the Constitution demanding impeachment and the trial of President Obama for murder?
Well, Corey, I have serious concerns about the way we use drones, and I agree with you that I don't think Americans can be targeted. Where it becomes fuzzy if you have an American working for a terrorist organization and is in a vicinity with other terrorists, that's where you got a gray area. I think before we start talking about impeaching the President of the United States, I think we should understand what's going on politically in this country, and that we have a Republican Party from day one. Somebody asked me a question before about, don't Republicans understand what it means to this country internationally when we keep attacking and attacking and attacking the President of the United States and weakening the United States of America? And all of this impeachment stuff is, I'm fearful, part of that process. We have a right-wing Republican Party right now, which from day one, literally on the day that Obama was inaugurated, was meeting. Leadership was meeting, and they were saying, what is the most effective way to prevent Obama from accomplishing anything? And we have seen a level of obstructionism in Congress that is unprecedented in modern American history. There is nothing that we can get through in the Senate, despite the fact that the Democratic caucus has a 55-45 majority, because on every important issue, Republicans demand 60 votes. That is a level of obstructionism never before seen. So, you know, before we talk about impeaching the President of the United States, let's talk about how we can begin to pass legislation responding to the many, many crises facing this country. You know, one area that we're working on right now, everybody knows, Tom, that our roads and bridges and water plants and wastewater plants are in desperate need of repair. And everybody knows that if we invest in rebuilding our infrastructure, we can create many, many millions of jobs and make this country more productive. And yet we can't get the Republicans to start investing in our infrastructure and getting this country to be more productive and creating jobs. So, you know, let's focus on where the real problems are.
Yeah, we have about 45 seconds. I had Newt Gingrich on this program earlier in the year, and I said, did you really sit in on a meeting with, you know, Pete Sessions and Kevin McCarthy and Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor and a bunch of senators? There's 14 of them all together in the caucus room restaurant for 4 hours. And did Pete Sessions actually say you were going to become the Taliban insurgency? And did Kevin McCarthy actually say we're going to fight the president on every bill, no matter what? And you know, I expected him to say, well, maybe we overstretched or something. He said, yes, you know, we're the opposition. That's what the opposition does. He was bragging about it.
Well, here's the point. You know, that's in a democratic society, the opposition does have a role to critique and offer better ideas. That's called democracy. But these guys have taken their level of obstructionism to a horrendously dangerous place, and the likes of which we have not seen in the modern history of this country.
Yeah, I agree. I think if this happened during the founding era, there would be a front. John Adams would have put these guys in jail under the Alien and Sedition Act. Anyhow, I said that, not you. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
First, John Adams put Ben Franklin's grandson in jail for publishing a newspaper article. Anyhow, back with more of Senator Sanders right after the Sanders.Senate.gov. Check it out. And welcome back. Gus in New York City, listening on WBAI, our Pacifica affiliate. There you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey there. I wanted to ask about the FCC ruling a couple months ago in May that basically struck down the Zapple Doctrine, which was the quasi-equal time provision. I would like to know if there's any Senate committee or any oversight of the FCC, and the fact that they said that because of the Fairness Doctrine is no longer being enforced, that the Zapple Doctrine is no longer going to be forced either.
I can't give you, I just don't know, Gus, and I'm sorry that I can't give you a good answer on that. What I do know, and Tom and I have talked about this a whole lot and why I do this show, and have done it for so many years, and why I think Tom Hartman is really an American hero in what he does, is we live in an era where, like almost every aspect of our lives, you have a small number of very large corporate entities which dominate the situation, and that's certainly true in the media. And one of the reasons we are where we are today in this country, where in this next election some 60% of the American people are not going to vote, and 70-80% of low-income working people will not vote, and why many people really do not have a clue about what's going on in Washington, has to do with, I think, very bad media reporting. And I think you have a corporate concentration of ownership, which is very dangerous. We're going to fight as hard as we can to maintain net neutrality so that as many voices as possible, regardless of their political views, can get out to the American people in a fair way, and we're going to do our best to make sure that voices like Tom Hartman's and others can continue to get out with a perspective that is very different from the corporate media. So that's my concern in that area.
Thank you, Senator. Lincoln in Barrie, Vermont. You are on the air with your senator.
Hi, Bernie.
Hey, Lincoln. How are you?
Pretty good. Last time I saw you was at Stumbridge Fair. So anyway, this is what I got going on. I am a veteran, and my oldest son is a veteran. He got over in Fallujah, and he was over in Afghanistan in those areas, and he got injured from those from bombs and stuff, and he's been having trouble with his benefits and stuff with his knee and stuff. But just to let you know, it's a big hassle sometimes to get through with the VA. What I myself would like to see happen is a separate entity that the veterans can go to, an omnibus sort of thing that they can represent them. But these people have some teeth that can deal with these situations, because the VA has just got too much damn red tape. It's just hard to get these patients, these vets in.
Right.
And I don't understand why they can't run it the same way you do a regular hospital. Why do they have to go through all this unimaginable paperwork, Murray? I don't know if you've ever seen this. You've got to have your 214. You've got to have this. You've got to have that. You've got to have all these foolish forms.
Lincoln, before you get off the air here, what I'd like you to do is give my office in Burlington a ring.
Okay.
862-0657. Tell us the situation of your son, and we will do our best to help him.
All right, thanks, Bernie. You take care. Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Lincoln. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders right after this. Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our National Town Hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website, and Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Linda? Linda does not appear to be there. Let's try Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Charles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, good afternoon, Senator Sanders.
Hi.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, Tom. My question is basically, do the Democrats have a plan where we're going to, you know, bring up some type of jobs plan before the election? And would it include anything that would get some of these young kids just coming out of high school or even in high school to take up some type of vocational courses that's practically free? Because yesterday there was a caller on Tom Hartman yesterday, and he was an entrepreneur. He was saying that part of the reason why he didn't hire so many people or something like that was because lack of experience. Now, you can't have experience if you don't have a job. And then you can't have a job if you don't have experience. So are we going to, you know, try to put some type of programs in place for these young kids that's almost out of school or are probably out of, you know, graduated already and, you know, trying to get into the workforce that's going to give employers, good employees, you know, or give them a better pool of employees that's got experience in whatever fields, you know, they're trying to take up.
Charles raises an enormously important issue. I thank him for raising it. For a start, what we don't talk about too much, Charles, is that youth unemployment in this country, we don't talk about it. Real youth unemployment is close to 20%. Youth unemployment in the African American community is close to 40%. What Charles is saying is that a lot of these kids come out of school or they drop out and they don't have the skills that they need to get into the jobs that are available. So to answer Charles's question, yes, there are a number of pieces of legislation that are trying to match the young people and their training with the jobs that are available. It doesn't do you any good to come out of school with some knowledge that is not applicable to getting a job. So I think there is a lot of consciousness in Congress about that. There are various pieces of legislation in a lot of communities, community colleges, high schools are working with local employers to say, all right, what are the skill sets that young people need in order to get a job with you? And in some places, they're working very close with these employers. So, Charles, you raise a very, very important issue, and it is something that members of Congress are working on.
Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, thank you for everything you're doing for the post office.
Thank you.
Many of us down here, we are right with you. We know what's going on. It was announced on our floor 2 weeks ago that they are going through and they are going to be closing 82 processing plants across the country. And what can we do as carriers and help our clerks? Because my husband is a clerk for the post office. What can we do to stop them?
Well, Linda, I just met.
Be insane.
What Linda is saying is absolutely right. Postmaster General has announced his intentions to shut down 82 processing plants. I think that's something like 15,000 jobs gone, plus the fact that it'll slow mail delivery, which is part of what we call a death spiral. You lower quality service, fewer people who use the postal office, less revenue comes in, more people, service deteriorates, on and on it goes. So to answer Linda, what I will tell you is we just had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with the some of the unions and others to talk precisely about how we can prevent the shutdown of these processing plants. It is something we are working very hard on, Linda. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that these 82 processing plants are not shut down. There are various ways that we could do it, and we're going to explore those ways.
Svetlana in Sammamish, Wisconsin, Washington State, listening on KBCS. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Actually, this is Kurt from Cali.
Oh, okay.
How you doing, Tom? How you doing, Uncle Bernie?
How are you?
Hey, I want you to know I've been calling you Uncle Bernie since the first day I saw you on the air, man. You're a wonderful guy, and I hope you run for president, you and both Elizabeth Warren, just to keep the topics on focus. We need to get our country back in shape financially. We need to get our financial house in order. All right, to my main point, why is it that we are allowing John Boehner to try to sue the president for supposedly not doing his job? And if we're going to sit by and allow that to happen, if the position of John Boehner is that the president has been derelict in his duty or did something, not doing his job, the Congress hasn't been doing their job either. So is it not possible for the people to do a class action against the Congress and sue John Boehner for doing their job? Because 80%, if you take a poll – almost on topic after topic after topic, like Vice President Biden said, the American people, 80% of them want gun control. 80% of the people want a raising minimum wage. 80% of the people want a lot of things done, and they're not doing it.
You got it. No, the issue is, here's what's going on. Republicans are very good at deflecting attention away from their desire to accomplish nothing and to obstruct Obama in every possible way. So here you have a situation where Obama said, look, I got a dysfunctional Congress. The Republicans don't want to do anything except give more tax breaks to people who don't need it and cut programs for working families. They're not doing anything. So I'm going to have to use the concept of the executive order as strongly as I can if we're going to do anything. And then the Republicans, whose goal in life is to accomplish nothing, to obstruct Obama, then they want to sue him because he's trying to do something. Now, the truth is, as the president would be the first to admit, there are real limits to what you can accomplish with executive orders. You need strong legislation to accomplish anything. But now they're very upset that the president wants to accomplish at least something, while they do nothing. And, you know, I don't think we have to sue John Boehner. What we have to do is, in this coming election, organize people, educate people, and take control of the United States Congress away from John Boehner. That would be the most effective political action that we could do, and that would be an enormous step forward for our country.
Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thank you so much for being with us again today.
Well, thank you. We'll see you soon.
Always an honor. And we will be back with not just Anything Goes Friday, but Reverend William Barber is going to be with us, and Mayor Adam O'Neill, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina, who is marching to Washington, D.C. from his small town to call for a Medicaid expansion in the second and third hour of our program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And it is going to be Anything Goes Friday, but we do have a couple of guests. At the top of this hour, Reverend Barber, and at the top of the next hour, Mayor Adam O'Deal, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina, who is marching to Washington, D.C. for single-payer health, or excuse me, for an expansion of Medicaid. Reverend William Barber is with us. He's the president of the North Carolina NAACP. His website, RevWilliamBarber.com. Reverend Barber, welcome back to the program.
How you doing, Tom? It's always good to be on with you.
Thank you. It's always great to have you with us. You have this remarkable article, How to Build a Powerful People's Movement. If we can do it in North Carolina, don't tell me we can't do it across America. I'm with you. I'd like you to talk about that. And also, but let me just start. What's up?
Well, you know, down in Belhaven, North Carolina, somewhere that's off the media map, but is now on the media map, we have seen the denial of Medicaid in North Carolina and the corporate greed of a company by the name of Vidant Hospital attempt to close the Pungo Hospital, which has been in existence more than 60 years, was put in existence by the Hill-Burton Act when Republicans and Democrats came together years ago. It serves 25,000 people. The two counties it serves are 20 and 24% of the people in poverty. 33% and 60% of the people in the two counties, Buford and Hyde County, are below the poverty level. And yet, because our state, Tom Tillis, who's Speaker of the House, and Governor McCoy denied Medicaid expansion, this hospital is about to close. In fact, it has closed its doors. We're fighting for an injunction to keep it open through the U.S. Department of Civil Rights. And we're in an emergency, Tom, when it comes to rural health care. And I've joined with a Republican mayor. I'm an independent. The NAACP is nonpartisan. This Republican mayor, who's a conservative, has said, look, to his own party, it's wrong for you to deny Medicaid expansion. It's wrong to take billions of dollars from these hospitals that will keep them open. And he's joined with the Forward Together Mom movement. We've joined with him to fight for rural hospitals and to fight for Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, and he will, in fact, be with us at this time and 1 hour from now. In your article, you write, if we learn our history, if we ask people to go deeper than just left or right, Democrat or Republican, we can transform America. If we can build a coalition in North Carolina, in Mitchell County, which is 98% white and 89% Republican, don't tell me we can't build a coalition across America. Tell us what you're talking about.
Well, it's true. Fusion politics in the 1800s in the South was black and white people coming together, former slaves and Abraham Lincoln Republican, who decided to reshape the contour of America by reshaping the contour of the South. And what did they come together around? They came together around some moral principles. They said that they were going to fight for education, voting rights, labor rights, even way back in the 1860s, fairness in the criminal justice system, and voting rights would be at the center of their agenda. Using that, they transformed the South. Of course, there was a reaction to it called the Redemption Movement, a group of people who decided they wanted to take back America. And basically what they meant was destroying the fusion between black and white people working together. They, in fact, did it through violence, through intimidation, through taking over the courts. But then again, it happened in the 1960s. Black, white, Latino women now come together, push America forward. What did we get? Changes in Social Security law, Medicaid, Medicare, the war on poverty, Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65. And then, of course, that strategy was undermined by the white Southern strategy. The point I'm trying to make is that history has already taught us that when we build transformative fusion coalition, we can change the South, we can change America, and we need to use that same model today, and that's what the Forward Together Mall movement is doing, and that's why we're shifting the political gravity in our state. Tom, when we started, our governor was at 50% in the polls, and, you know, denying Medicaid, denying unemployment, denying earned income tax credit, denying access to teachers and public education, and attacking the vote. He's 50% in the polls. But after we shifted the conversation, now he's under 30 and falling. The legislature was over 40% of the poll. Now they're under 18%. 58% of North Carolinians now want Medicaid expansion.
Wow.
60% are against the attacks on voting. Because when we show people our common destiny, we can move the state in another direction.
Do you think, you know, I mean, given the intensity of the gerrymandering there in North Carolina, is there any possibility that this election could see the recapturing of the state by Democrats?
Well, it may not in total, because you're right. They have cheated and written the kind of gerrymandering system that we're in court fighting right now. You know, they stacked 52% of African Americans into 27 out of 120 House districts, and 50% of African Americans into 19 out of 50 Senate districts. But we have a statewide election, the Senate race. And nobody knows if people vote their fears and vote in mass and vote in ways we don't expect in the off year election, what could in fact happen? So that's why we have 50 young people in 50 counties organizing and doing voter registration, registering 50,000 new registered voters. We have a movement in this state. What we know is we've never seen these kind of numbers in terms of the ratings of the governor and the legislature. They are as low as ever because people of all parties are tired of this. We had 1,000 people arrested. 16% of them were independents and Republicans, did civil disobedience. 80,000 people showed up in February. So we don't really know, because this is a fresh Reconstruction movement. What we do know is that people are engaged like never before. We've heard now that Tom Tillis is under Senator Hagan in the polls. And while we're not partisan, we certainly are deeply political, and that is we're going to push people out to the polls. And our movement is not going to stop after November. It's going to continue.
You've been really successful in North Carolina. And what's your advice to somebody who's in Louisiana or Alabama or Wyoming or Michigan? What's your advice to an individual who might be watching or listening right now and saying, what can I do?
Yeah. Listen, if Adam O'Neill, a Republican, and I can come together, people ought to be able to come together and use Let's build these indigenously led transformative fusion movements that are anti-racist, anti-poverty, and deeply moral. Let's use the deepest moral traditions of our Constitution and our faith to get away from this language of left and right that automatically isolates people, or conservative versus liberal. And let's find the language that says some decisions are not left or right, they're at the moral center. Caring for the poor, moral center. Providing public education, moral center. Providing health care, moral center. Providing earned income tax credit, unemployment, moral center. Protecting voting rights at the moral center. And we believe if you do that, and you can hook up with the NAACPs in your states and hook up with labor and hook up with faith communities and others, we can in fact build transformative coalitions around this country. We've already seen about 9 started in different places across state. I was in Arkansas a few weeks ago. 150 people showed up of every different race, creed, and color talking about organizing. Same thing happened in Missouri. We're on our way to Indiana now. Something is breaking out in Florida, in Alabama. People are longing for a way to address this moral crisis, Tom. And because the reality is when you have a Tea Party extremism that says the best way to a better America is to deny health care, deny education, deny labor rights, deny women's rights, deny LGBT rights, fight the president on every turn, deny voting rights, and then give everybody a gun. That's just ludicrous. It makes no sense. It is the road to destruction politically. We can get people to go to the higher ground if we dare to do it, and we'll come together.
Yeah. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And you are doing it. You're one of my heroes, I got to tell you. Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II, his article, How to Build a Powerful People's Movement, over at thenation.com. And, of course, Rev. William Barber, R-E-V, WilliamBarber.com, his website. Reverend Barber, thanks so much for the great work you're doing and for being with us today and sharing.
Thank you so much, and I hope your listeners are going. In that article, you know, it's 12 steps.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Get 10 seconds. No? Okay. Reverend Barber's talking. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Anything Goes Friday. You know, Anything Goes Summer, so it's like really anything goes. So, do fried rats make good burgers? I don't know. It was the weirdest thing I could think of. Anyhow, really, actually, I've seen fried rats being sold on the streets in Taiwan. I think in Hong Kong. I was never quite sure if they were rats. I know in Taiwan they were. Anyhow, Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. There was a caller a little while back who was saying that the president should be impeached for killing Al Awlaki with a drone.
Yep.
And but what he left out was Al Awlaki was involved in the underwear bomber plot on an airliner that almost killed hundreds of people over Detroit.
Was he? I thought he was just making obnoxious videos on behalf of Al-Qaeda.
No, he was involved in plots, you know. I don't Google it or whatever.
Well, still, I'm of the opinion, and I can't speak for Bernie, but I'm of the opinion that if we're going to execute somebody, even if we're going to do it by remote control with a drone, we should first have a court. I mean, there should be a trial, and there was certainly enough time for the president or the administration to convene a grand jury, present the evidence against this guy. Have the grand jury indict him, take it before a jury of Americans, have them indict him, convict him, sentence him to death, and then pull the trigger on him. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Well, he was in Pakistan, so it's impossible.
Oh, no, it's not impossible. There's this thing called trial in absentia. It's done all the time.
Yeah, but how would you stop him from recruiting people to kill thousands of Americans? It's kind of like if there's a sniper shooting innocent people from a building.
Well, no, he was recruiting people to kill thousands of Americans all during that time.
The police have the duty to use deadly force on that person. The president had a duty.
Paul, it wasn't like he started doing it the day. Paul, it wasn't like he started doing it the day before the president killed him with a drone. He'd been doing it for months. There was and we had been complaining about it for months. There was plenty of time for a trial.
Okay, and. But what,
I mean, a trial can take 3 days.
Time, inciting people to kill Americans. You know,
if that is a crime, and you know, we can that's a whole other conversation. But if that's a crime worthy of punishment by death, then have a trial. That's I mean the fifth,
yeah,
sixth,
and then how
seventh,
many
and eighth amendments
in the meantime,
of the Constitution.
Though? How many people die in the meantime? I mean, you have to take action when someone's actually almost killed hundreds of people. That plane was almost brought down.
But my point is, Paul, we knew this for months. The administration was complaining about Al Awlaki for months. They took them a long time to track him down and get him in the beads of a drone. And any time during that period of time, they could have had a trial, and we would have elevated our stature in the world as being people who respect the rule of law. And now, as a consequence of what we did, if Mexico decides that one of their drug lords is really a bad guy who decides to die, and he's living in an apartment building in downtown Phoenix, and they decide to fly a drone over Phoenix and take out that building and maybe kill a couple hundred people along with Pablo Escobar, they can say, hey, we're just doing what America does. We set a really bad precedent. That's my point. And I just think that either you stand for the rule of law or not, either you stand for the Constitution or you don't. And in this particular case, and I'm very supportive of this administration generally, but in this particular case, I think they went too far. 20 minutes past. The hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Gary in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Gary, you had a question about the Sherman Act?
Hey, Dr. Hartman, I'm happy to talk to you again. My concern is with the Sherman Act, which hasn't been enforced since the Reagan administration, which led to the too big to fail banks, but now is currently threatening by lack of enforcement to allow Comcast and TWC to merge, allow AT&T and DirecTV to merge, and so much for net neutrality.
Right.
Your thoughts?
Oh, I share your horror. The Sherman Act is still on the books, and there's about 8 or 9 bills that have been passed over the years that strengthen or fine-tune it or sharpen it in some ways. And Reagan stopped enforcing those in 83. No president since then has seen fit to enforce them. They're all afraid that if they break up a big company, it'll hurt the economy. The reality was that, you know, when Nixon initiated an antitrust action against AT&T and Jimmy Carter finished it, it took quite some time, that AT&T broke into, as I recall, seven companies altogether, 6 individual operating companies, the baby Bells, the regional Bells, and Bell Labs, which was renamed Lucent Technologies. And if you own stock in AT&T the day before the breakup, you were given share, you know, a proportionally one-seventh as much stock in each one of those 7 companies. A week later, you were much wealthier than before the breakup. All these companies did much better as a consequence of the breakup. Innovation in telecom in the United States exploded as a consequence of the breakup. Competition proliferated as a result of the breakup. It was kind of, you know, there was a couple of years there. It was kind of the golden age of telecom in the United States. And
I was an employee of Lucent Technologies, and so I witnessed the whole thing. And what AT&T did was they broke up AT&T,
Bell Labs.
Yeah, AT&T and Lucent, and because AT&T wanted to go over the big fish, after the big fish, the ISPs, the phone companies, et cetera.
Right.
A year later, they were acquired by Alcatel, while Avaya, which was Lucent's new name, became the number one provider of business communications for companies.
Was that 81, 82?
No, it was actually about 2002.
Oh, okay. That's much more recent. Okay.
So, yeah. So anyway, my point is net neutrality is a scary subject for us, and this business of not enforcing the Sherman Act has really been the net cause, I think, of, you know, too big to fail, destroyed the economy.
I agree.
And now it's going to take away our ability to have internet at reasonable prices.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Why doesn't somebody, if they're going to sue somebody, why don't they sue Holder?
Yeah.
For failing to,
I would submit a friend of the court brief if they did. The reality is that the situation that modern presidents find themselves in since Reagan did this, and I think, you know, Bush continued it aggressively, the first Bush. Bill Clinton was perhaps a little more ambivalent about it, but he was presented with the reality about corporate power at that point in time, particularly given the Buckley versus Vallejo decision in 76 and the First National Bank in 77 that recognized money as being protected by the First Amendment in 76 and in 77 said not only is it recognized by the First Amendment, but it's accessible to corporations, money for political purposes. That what they're facing is something very similar to what Thomas Jefferson wrote about slavery. And Thomas Jefferson is one of the few founders who was a slave owner whose first piece of legislation when he was in the House of Burgesses was to end slavery. He tried to end slavery almost 30 times during his career, and most of those times he was severely punished for it by his peers. And he went to his death screaming about how we had to end slavery. In fact, one of the last letters he wrote in 1828 was predicting the Civil War, and he said, "My only solace is that I shall not live to die to cry over it." This suicide that he said we are foisting upon ourselves by slavery. But the famous quote from Jefferson is, you know, about slavery, and I think he was reflecting the. Sorry about the fire truck going by outside. I think he was reflecting the perspective of many of the anti-slavery slave owners of that time. He said, "We have a wolf by the ears, and we don't know how to hold him, and we don't know how to let him go." And this is the problem that modern-day presidents have with these giant transnational corporations. if Obama tomorrow was to say, you know, we're going to start really breaking up, not just the big banks, we're going to break up all the big corporations. Any corporation that owns more than 5% of any market share nationally or owns more than 10% of any market share in any state within its individual industry has to break up to pieces that will equal that or some other, you know, that's a relatively arbitrary number, but it's in the neighborhood of what was enforced with regard to the Sherman Act back during the Teddy Roosevelt administration. If he was to do that, he would immediately have hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe tens of billions of dollars, dumped into the political party of the opposition party, into the candidacy, into private things. He would be excoriated on TV. He would be impeached. There's no doubt about it. He, you know, to the extent that they've been obstructing him, they would go way beyond that. It'd be a fight royale. I'd love to see him do it. And I frankly think that Elizabeth Warren may have the courage to do it. And I think Bernie Sanders might have the courage to do it. But I think that President Obama has a substantial investment in the status quo. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, he's president of the United States. He's part of the machine. And at least keeping it running so that it can be helpful to people over the short term, you know, trying to get unemployment extended and these kind of things. So I think that I think this is the calculus presidents have made, that he made and Bill Clinton made, is if we roll back Ronnie Reagan's legacy, there's going to be a short time, you know, a couple of years, 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 or 6 years, where it's going to be very, 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 very difficult. And there's not, frankly, the funding of the bureaucracy and the Justice Department to do it right now. Republicans have cut the funding. Gary, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
See, it's not so much that we need another FDR. It's that we need another populace that is as engaged as one was the one that elected and pushed FDR. Oh, this is fascinating. There's this guy, Mr. Comar, C-O-M-A-R, I'm assuming that's how he says it, who is suing the Bush-Cheney administration for the war in Iraq, saying that they began planning this back in 1997 and that it was motivated by personal enrichment and that the war was a crime of aggression. And instead of throwing it out, the judge asked for additional information. And it looks like the hearing for that additional information is going to be on 9/11, September 11th of this year. How ironic. Fascinating. The Bush administration, by the way, is being defended in court, in this case, by the Obama administration, which is claiming executive sovereignty. Basically, you can't pick on us for things we did while we were in office because we are immune from lawsuits. So, anyhow. There's one other thing I wanted to share with you very quickly, and then I'll get to your phone calls. 2014, Paul Armentano, writing over at Alternet, why 2014 is a major election year for marijuana reform. He talks about how Alaska, Florida, and Oregon are all going to have pot reform, in all three cases, decriminalization, same in District of Columbia, on the ballot in November. And this is what I've been predicting. You know, this is how it's supposed to happen. It's not supposed to happen by the Supreme Court coming in and saying, domini, 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 you're all pot smokers now. And when you look at women's suffrage, you see a very, very similar timeline. It was 1885, Utah gave women the right to vote. In 1896, Idaho gave women the right to vote, not in federal elections, but state elections. In 1902, they backtracked. In 1910, Washington State gave women the right to vote. In 1911, California gave women the right to vote. In 1912, male electorates, you know, only men were electing, in Michigan, Kansas, Oregon, and Arizona, all approved state constitutional amendments allowing women to vote for women's suffrage. The only state that defeated it was Wisconsin. Maybe Scott Walker's a reincarnation from that era. In 1912, Kentucky restored limited voting rights for women in school board elections. And then in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was passed, which gave women full rights to vote. So it's like these things happen in the states. You know, the states are the incubators of democracy step by step throughout the states. And then eventually, when it reaches a critical mass, it just kind of goes boom. Same way single-payer health care did in Canada and Saskatchewan when Tommy Douglas first proposed it as premier of Saskatchewan. And it worked so well that all the other provinces in Canada said, hey, that's really cool. I want some of that. And eventually the Canadian federal government stepped in and said, we're going to create some national standards and fill in the blanks for poor communities and poorer states or provinces versus richer, much like the federal government has done with education in the United States, to provide some sort of national standards. But that's how single-payer health care happened in Canada. I think that's how it's going to happen here in the United States, starting with Vermont in 2 years. But with regard to pot decriminalization, I think we're going down that exact same road. I think 5-10 years from now, you're going to see it everywhere. And we saw the same thing with gambling 20 years ago. You know, I mean, it used to be that Vegas was the only place in the United States you could go to gamble. Then New Jersey decided to change their laws, and Atlantic City came along. And now Atlantic City, they're about to close 3 casinos there because so many nearby states have legalized gambling. And then other states, even states where gambling is illegal, they decriminalized it for the state. In other words, they have lotteries and lotto and things like that. So, I see this as a good thing, step by step. I'm ambivalent about the gambling, but my point is that I see, you know, what people want, people get over time if they keep working for it, particularly at the state level. Laura in Chicago. Hey, Laura, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I was waiting to talk to Senator Sanders, and I'm asking you to ask him the question, okay, because I can't keep trying to come on Friday. And that is, he voted for the resolution in support of Israel. Every single senator did that.
Yeah, it was unanimous, was it not?
We have got to stop this. Everybody in the Middle East understands that we are not an arbitrator of real peace, that we are not neutral. And we give $3 billion a year of military aid to the rich country of Israel to continue their bombing of the imprisoned population of Gaza. This is ridiculous. This is not going to make us safer in this world.
Yeah. I can't speak for Bernie. I do know that he's fighting some very, very large battles that have to do with domestic economic issues. This is that's his wheelhouse, and now he's added Veterans Affairs to that. And just doing some amazing work in those areas. And were I doing that, were I to say, you know, I'm going to focus 100% of my efforts on the American middle class and the working poor in the United States and helping raise people up, and I knew that voting against Israel would cause, you know, me to be the next news cycle for 2 weeks and be subject to all kinds of incoming flack from the pro-Israeli media and demagogues like Rand Paul, who used to be opposed to foreign aid for Israel, but now suddenly is, you know, sucking up to them like there's no tomorrow because he wants to run for president. If I was in that position, I would probably say either not vote or just say, yeah, sure, what the heck. You know, I've got more important fish to fry. But I can't, you know, I can't speak for Bernie. You'll have to ask him. And,
yeah. And his not voting would have been great. His not voting would have been great. Yeah. But, Tom, we are never going to raise this country up unless we cut the military budget. And that means we end our incursions around the world.
Yeah, Laura, you're preaching to the choir here. And I think to a very significant extent, well, you know, I don't ever want to find myself in the position of trying to speak for anybody else, particularly a United States senator. So I can't speak. I'm not going to speak for Bernie. I'm just telling you how I feel about it. But, you know, keep calling. Typically what happens is, you know, we've got 12 incoming lines. Bernie, even within the first 5 minutes of the show, all 12 lines are full. Bernie tends to give long answers, and sometimes we only get through 6, 8, 10 calls in the course of the hour. Sometimes more. Sometimes people drop off and new people come on, and they're topics that Bernie is just hitting on, and so, you know, I'll go to them earlier than others. But, you know, keep trying. We'll get through to it, okay?
We must end our military empire. We have to do it or else we're going to all go down.
Well, we have to do it or it'll be imposed on us, just like it was on the United Kingdom after World War One. You know, they were a worldwide empire, and after World War One, they realized, okay, we're not anymore. It took them 30 years to realize it. It was 1956 when Churchill pulled out of Uganda, which I think was their last major, I mean, you could argue Ireland and Scotland still are, Northern Ireland and Scotland still are, but I think Uganda was their major non-local foot of empire. And so it took a while, but I think, frankly, the United States has to go through that same process. The rise of China is making it more difficult because you're seeing a reconsolidation of the old anti-Soviet lobby as the anti-China lobby. And now if there's more conflict with Russia, they may well become the anti-Russia lobby, too. So who knows? Laura, thank you for the call. James in Spring City, Tennessee. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I'm fine. How are you today? Well, it's actually, since you ask, our air conditioning has been off all day, which is why I'm sitting here wearing a Goats for the Old Goat T-shirt instead of my shirt. But it's a relatively cool day in D.C. We have the windows open, so it's only in the 80s rather than the 90s last week where we actually turned the lights off. So
almost skiing weather, isn't it?
Yeah, there you go. So what's up, James?
I guess I have a perspective that I like to ask in a question form, and that pertains to the Canadian tar sands and the carbon discharges and what that might be doing to the northern ice sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And also the methane gas release that's definitely going to be imminent behind these processes of global warming and what that might do to our bodies, seeing as we just don't exactly do well processing basically a toxic gas, and what this might do to our neurological patterns and basically our bodies.
Well, methane is not, I mean, methane is toxic to us in that, your body can't metabolize it. It's not a good thing to inhale, but carbon dioxide certainly, we exhale that continuously. It's not that these are toxic gases to us. They're toxic to our atmosphere, and that's the problem. And they're creating more global warming. And if our planet warms by two, some say as little as two, some say as much as 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, then we get these radical changes in our biosphere and our environment. We've already lost 50% of the sea life at the bottom of the sea web. The oceans are starting to die, and from absorbing more carbon dioxide, absorbing more heat, partly from the heat, mostly from the acidification from the carbon dioxide. And on land, we're losing 100 species a day. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And we are setting ourselves up for extinction. Every time there's been 5 major extinctions and a half a dozen minor ones, And all of them kill off the large mammals and the top large animals and the top predators. And that's what we are. We are a large animal, and we are the top predator. So ain't a good thing. Ain't a good thing. James, we got to do something about it. There's one of my favorite resources, by the way, is arctic-news.blogspot.com. Check it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we will, hopefully soon, in collaboration with Leonardo DiCaprio, be releasing another video on global warming. And welcome back, Robert, in Delhi, Louisiana. Hey, Robert, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Blessings on you and your family, Tom.
Thank you, sir. We'll take all we can get.
There are a lot of people in this country who love Jesus and his teachings. And we have a lot of people who are in politics and say, oh, we love Jesus. They don't love Jesus. What did Jesus teach? He didn't teach to be hateful or spiteful, to be kind and considerate. And all of us long for kindness and consideration. And we have to be considerate to people, even people we think are totally nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's because they need the love of Jesus and they don't have it.
Well, and they need the love of us too.
And Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, for anybody, even if you don't believe he's the Savior. He is his teachings. You can't go wrong by following his teachings. You just can't. And I don't understand why these people say they're Christians when they don't even act like it. I mean, it's a shame on them and a shame on us. And I just wanted to tell you, Tom, you're doing great work. And thank you so much, sir.
Well, thank you, Robert. Thank you for your kind words. And you know, I agree with you. I think very, very good sentiment. I would like, you know, real Christians to take back Christianity because it's been hijacked by a bunch of loonies. Well said. Thank you very much. Al, watching Free Speech TV in Rome, Wisconsin. Hey, Al, you wanted to talk about Anwar al-Awlaki?
Yeah, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
You surprised the hell out of me one day. The guy who called in had it wrong. He was killed in, I believe, Yemen.
Yeah.
He was nowhere near Pakistan. The FBI tried to recruit him to be a snitch. That's why he left the country.
Okay.
That's the facts behind it. I got that from Free Speech TV.
Okay. Yeah, I confess, Anwar al-Awlaki, I've reported the news stories, but it's not one of the things that I focus like a laser on. So if the guy had his facts wrong, I probably didn't catch. I obviously didn't catch them. My apologies. Are you calling to support my assertion that we had the time for there to be a trial, and even if we didn't have the time, the Constitution requires us to have a trial?
Yeah. And what about his kid?
Yeah, his 16-year-old kid was killed by us as well, and he had committed, to the best of my knowledge, no crimes whatsoever. So this is something that, you know, Americans need to start taking really seriously. Are we a nation of laws or are we lawless? And if we're lawless and we're above the law and we're going to assert that we can just, you know, go into any country we want with a drone and kill anybody that we've decided is a bad guy, does that apply to the rest of the world? And if it does apply to the rest, if it doesn't apply to the rest of the world, then we've got this real dissonance between, cognitive dissonance between the idea that we want everybody to be a democratic republic like the United States on the one hand, and on the other hand, but please don't do what we do. I mean, you know, that is like that. Well, it's called hypocrisy. And on the other hand, I think that, you know, let's give President Obama credit for at least stopping so many of the Bush administration. You know, we can agree that al-Awlaki, or many of us can agree that al-Awlaki should have been entitled to a jury of his peers. At least Obama stopped the torture, stopped the phrase war on terror. 10 minutes before the hour. Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman program does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. Just don't let Limbaugh know he'll want some. Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, I see you're in the White House.
Yes.
So what's going on?
Well, big doings in the White House this afternoon. President Obama and Vice President Biden will meet with the three leaders of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Guess what's on their agenda?
Yeah. At least one of those presidents, I read an article recently saying that more than 70% of his cabinet are gang members or narco traffickers?
Well, that wouldn't surprise me at all, because one of those countries has the highest murder rate in the world.
Yeah, I don't remember if it was Honduras or El Salvador.
Yeah, but two of the countries are up there. I mean, they're like competing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, these are not like places you want to put on your list for TripAdvisor.
Right. So is President Obama going to say, okay, you guys are president, I'm president, we got this problem, let's try and work it out? Or is he going to say to these guys, you guys are corrupt SOBs, you're ruining your countries,
He might be some of that. There might be a bit of that. There might be some conversation about aid. We might cut a bit of that out. But there is going to be some conversation about we've got to solve this problem. And one of the things that's likely to come up is this pilot program that has come out about youths from Honduras. that is going to be getting quite a lot of pushback from Republicans. The idea being, and I was just in the White House briefing room, I just left, and Josh Earnest, the spokesman, did not deny this program. The idea being that they would process several thousand, and it's hard to get them pinned down on the number, young people from Honduras in their home country to see if they reached some kind of humanitarian or refugee status and could come to the U.S. and so could avoid making that perilous journey.
Hmm. So rather than just catching refugees at the border, we're going to invite refugees to come here by plane?
Yes, apparently so. And the idea
is going to flip out the right wingers
and on the numbers. But when I get back into the briefing, I tend to put it to him that rather than decreasing the numbers, why wouldn't this just increase the numbers and you'd still have everybody coming over on the death train, and then you'd have this other track of people coming over on the planes.
Yeah, and not to mention, I mean, can you imagine what right wing talk radio is going to do with this thing?
Oh, they're going to love it. I mean,
as in hate it, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. This strikes me as a fascinating plan. He did not deny this. He said they were not announcing anything, but it's something that he believes he can do by executive order, which leads me to my next topic. And Dan Pfeiffer, senior advisor to the president, said at a Christian Science Monitor breakfast this morning that he believes that the Republicans in the House are quite likely considering impeachment of the president.
Impeachment?
Yes.
Wait a minute. I thought they were just going to sue him.
Well, Dan Pfeiffer said that the White House is taking the prospect of impeachment in the Republican-controlled House more seriously than many others in Washington who see it as unlikely.
Yeah. See, I think that after November, which is only roughly 100 days from now, that after those elections, if the Republicans take the Senate, I would bet you that there will be an impeachment attempt. But lacking the Senate, it would be purely symbolic, and it would tie up the House. And on the other hand, it gives everybody a chance to get up and give a speech and demagogue, just like they did against Clinton, and not do anything at all for the economy or the people, just like they did during Clinton. But on the third hand, it really hurt them during Clinton.
It hurt them. And there's a new CNN ORC International poll out today showing that nearly two-thirds of American public are against impeachment, while only 35% support it.
But they haven't heard the argument yet. I mean, yeah, on the fourth hand, there was no Fox News during the Clinton impeachment.
That's correct.
And right-wing talk radio was pretty much just Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
So there is a right-wing infrastructure right now in place that could be a real significant game changer.
Right, that's possible. So the White House is taking the impeachment talk seriously.
Wow, okay. What else is there?
Meanwhile, over in Cairo, Secretary of State John Kerry has drafted a new ceasefire proposal and presented it to the Israelis and those who are negotiating on behalf of Hamas. There is supposed to be some kind of an announcement today.
Mm-hmm.
The ceasefire, if it is agreed to by both sides, would start on Sunday for a week.
Hmm.
Here's what I believe is the sticking point. Israeli Defense Force troops will not leave the Gaza Strip entirely and will continue to locate and destroy Hamas tunnels.
And Hamas will not agree to that.
That's my thinking.
Yeah, I would guess you're probably right. What if the IDF, the Israeli army guys, were replaced by an international force with the same mission to find tunnels and destroy?
That might be more palatable, particularly if all the attacks ceased and everything else. That might be possible. I just don't think
although,
they would accept Israelis.
You know, if a bunch of American and French and British troops were to go in and start blowing up tunnels, are they going to come under attack just like the Israelis were? And then now we're in a shooting war.
Well, then that's tricky, too.
Yeah. Huh.
In theory, during the ceasefire, Israel and Hamas begin negotiations on a more permanent arrangement with Egyptian mediation, and the Palestinian Authority will participate in the talks. And the U.S., the U.N. Secretary General, and the EU provide guarantees to both sides that the negotiations will deal with issues important to them.
Wow.
So we'll see how all that goes.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, after a major spat yesterday, key lawmakers are back at work on a possible deal to reform the Veterans Affairs Department with just 1 week to go before the August recess.
Is this in the Senate or the House?
This is between the Senate and the House.
Oh, interesting. Is this a piece of legislation that's gone to reconciliation, or they're
yes.
both just collateral? They're both parallel working.
Yeah, that reconciliation.
Oh, very interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you for the third hour of our program. Mayor Adam O'Neill, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina. The website saveourhospital.org. Mayor Adam O'Neill is back with us. Mayor, welcome.
Great to be with you again. Thank you for showing interest in our calls. We really appreciate it.
Well, I thank you for having the cause. I mean, you're doing really important work out there. How are your feet holding up? You've been marching from Belhaven, North Carolina to here in Washington, D.C. How's it going?
Well, I may have told you last time, everybody on the trip has gotten blisters. Even my mother, who's driving our support van, she has gotten a blister from driving the car.
Wow.
But I've been fortunate at this point. I had to put my first moleskin on this morning because I might have had a little blister coming on my heel.
Yeah.
But we're doing good. We're within about 40 miles of Washington, D.C., and we will be there Monday morning.
Wow, that's great. And I think we're going to have you on TV Monday night, as I recall.
Fantastic.
We were talking
about joining you.
Yeah, and so just for our listeners and viewers who may not recall or know or maybe didn't hear the first segment, tell us what's going on. Why is a white Republican mayor in Belhaven, North Carolina, a little town in North Carolina, marching to Washington, D.C. with many civil rights activists and people of color, as well as a lot of white guys. What's going on? What's this all about?
Well, we're trying to bring attention to rural hospitals, and one of the issues of rural hospitals is Medicaid expansion. You have these critical access hospitals, particularly out in rural America, that have a hard time breaking even every year. And with the indigent care reimbursement that's fallen, Medicaid expansion is very important to offset the lost revenues. And in the states where they're not accepting Medicaid expansion, the hospitals are really having a difficult time. And hospitals like my community are even being faced with closing. But we also have an epidemic in our country where these large healthcare conglomerates are coming in and buying small hospitals, like the Vidant Health that bought our hospital, and basically have designs on closing them to force people to other hospitals they own nearby, trying to cut their expenses to make more money. We have a situation, I think your listeners really need to hear this. We've got a nonprofit company, nonprofit by the IRS code company called Vidant Health that made $127 million in 2012, made $109 million in 2013, have got $550 million in reserves, and they closed a critical access hospital, earlier this month. And it's outrageous. And the other thing we're trying to do is ask for some bill to be put forth where the Health and Human Services Secretary has to sign off before you can close a critical access hospital. Those are the things that are really important to us.
Yeah, I mean, this would be outrageous even if it was a for-profit company, but it's even worse as a nonprofit company. Now, tell me if my understanding of the events here is correct. Back in the 80s, during the Reagan administration, there was a crisis of people showing up at hospitals sick in the emergency rooms and the ERs turning them away. And so Ronald Reagan signed legislation that said that if somebody comes to an emergency room with an emergency, the hospital has to see them whether they have insurance or not, and if they don't, the hospital has to absorb the cost. And in response to that, there was federal funding, whether it was direct or block grant, I frankly don't know, but there was some federal programs, federal funding to hospitals to help cover the cost of their ERs. Am I right so far?
That's correct. And critical access hospitals got higher reimbursements than hospitals that weren't designated critical access.
Right. Okay. So
and
then
the reason for that is because of the geographic areas they're located where people don't have adequate care.
Right. So then when Obamacare was being written, the predicating assumption, because the Supreme Court had not yet given states the ability to refuse to take Medicaid expansion, and the law explicitly says every state has to. So when they wrote the state, they said, we really don't need these Reagan-era financial supports for these critical care at small hospitals for their ER's activity for uninsured people, because everybody's going to have insurance. And so we're going to do away with that and replace it with this Medicaid expansion. But then in your state, for example, Pat McCrory and the Republicans in the House of Representatives and the Senate said, we're not going to take the money, even though it's, you know, we our citizens paid that money in tax dollars to Washington, D.C., and D.C. is offering to give it back to us. And then when somebody shows up at an ER, they'll actually be able to pay the bill because they have Medicaid. They'll be insured. We're not going to take the money to try to basically screw the president. And thus, the money went away because Obamacare did take away that Reagan care money. You know, on the assumption it would be replaced
exactly.
by Medicaid expansion, but John Roberts said you don't have to take it, and you got people like Pat McCrory saying, cool, we're not going to take it. Am I right on that?
You're right on that, because the indigent care reimbursements are what you're talking about. With Obamacare, they start going down,
right.
but they're to be replaced with Medicaid expansion. And when you have the indigent care reimbursements falling and nothing to replace those revenues, you have pressure put on the hospitals. And the hospitals that don't make $100 million a year, the critical access hospitals where heart surgeries, cancer treatments, and all that aren't done at those facilities, they're basically there for emergency care and some hospital beds. Those facilities can't take this because they're just barely breaking even all over the country right now. We're
right.
going to have a rural hospital epidemic of closing of hospitals if we don't do something.
So you and a group of friends and associates, and people can learn more about this over at SaveOurHospital.org. You all are marching from Belhaven, North Carolina to Washington, D.C. You're going to arrive here in D.C. on Monday. And, you know, on behalf of this issue, what are your specific requests? What are you going to do when you get here?
Well, they can also follow me on Twitter at Mayor O'Neill, and please donate money. I want to get that in.
You got it.
Help us. The things we're trying to do, once again, is bring more attention to Medicaid expansion and get the facts out about it. Number two, HHS to sign off if a critical access hospital is to be closed. Also, we want a situation where communities have at least a year to try and save their hospital if things go bad. And the last thing is we want to bring attention to what Vital Health did to our community. Not only is it a health care crisis, our area's main industry is retirees retiring as a waterfront area, waterfront community. So we have a situation where they have ripped the economic heart out of our community as well. And all this while we have business plans that show our hospital can be profitable. So a big conglomerate comes in and shuts down a hospital that could be profitable, well-run, shut it down to force people to go to another hospital. And this is a nonprofit whose mission is to provide health care in Northeast North Carolina, and they're closing critical access hospitals. That should be against the law.
Do you know if mayors have the authority to seize property under eminent domain? And if so, have you considered seizing this hospital?
We're going to try every method possible. I've got Bob Zellner with me, a civil rights activist.
Uh-huh.
I was talking to him about it, and I keep calling him a liberal, and he keeps telling me he's a radical. But anyway, you know, we're going to take every measure we can.
Yeah.
I mean, if the thing in Washington don't work, we're going to keep right on pushing. Because
yeah.
the reality is people are going to die. So if you're the mayor of a town and people are dying, should you do all you can to stop it? I think you should.
What now? Your party in general is committed to destroying the Obama presidency no matter what, and including stupid things like not taking Medicaid expansion. Are you getting trashed by your colleagues, your Republican colleagues?
No, not really at all. I've talked to several of my Republican friends, and you know, they say, well, you do what you think's right, and that's what I'm doing.
That's
great. And I think we all have to put people over politics. This is an issue where literally people are dying. They are dying, not going to die. They are dying. And we need to do something about it because, you know, when we talk about people, we need to think about Portia Gibbs, 48-year-old mother of three, wife, who just passed away. Well, her husband's laying in bed at night by himself. Those kids don't have a mother to call up and talk to. I mean, this is real people.
She just died in your town, in your community.
You know, machine.
She just died in your community because the hospital had been shut down. Do I have that right?
She died 4 days after the hospital was closed with a heart attack.
My God. This is, and these guys call themselves Christians and doing this stuff. Mayor Adam O'Neill, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina. The website is saveourhospital.org. The Twitter is Mayor O'Neill. That's O-N-E-A-L. And kick him some funds, too, if you can. In fact, Danielle's going to tweet out. We're going to tweet out you, Mayor O'Neill, with a thing that says, you know, please help out. Give some money. Mayor O'Neill, thank you.
Thank you a lot.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We will be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Jim, you want to talk about the fast diet?
Yeah, I just heard you a couple of days ago saying you were going back to your roots.
Yeah, I'm going back to Arnold Arrett's mucusless diet healing system.
Yeah, I just had a friend
eating an apple.
Swedish, and he went back to Sweden to get his physical.
Uh-huh.
And I met him in AA about 13, 14 years ago. And he still was having a problem with drinking. He has like a 45-year drinking history. Mm. In and out of the hospital the last 13 years. And went to get his physical. And the doctor called him to congratulate him for having the body of a 30-year-old man. And he says, what about my liver? 30-year-old liver.
Is this because he's been doing a fast diet?
He's been on a fast diet for 10 months.
Yeah.
And I have no proof, but after a 45-year drinking history,
yeah,
it's...
The experience that Louise and I had with this was that it wasn't a lifestyle as much as it was a discipline, and that we had to figure out what 2 days of the week we were going to modify all of our normal patterns and you know, that kind of thing. And it just, you know, it was difficult to do. And whereas... when we first got married, we went on this mucusless diet healing system, which basically Arnold Arrett has this theory that all animal products, all oils, concentrated foods, and all grains form mucus in the body, and that mucus is the basis of all disease. Now, you know, this was in 1922. It sounds a little unsophisticated, but basically his diet was fruit and green leafy vegetables and nuts and seeds, but not grains. And Louise was on that diet, and then he was also a fan of fruitarianism. He just eating a fruit diet, but only for limited periods of time. We were both on the mucusless diet for about a year, and then Louise got pregnant, and she stayed on that, although she occasionally supplemented it with starchy vegetables like squash and things. And I went on a fruitarian diet, and I went down to 110 pounds. I reached the point where I thought, you know, I've gone too far. But I was getting some amazing states of consciousness. I mean, it was like my meditations were mind-blowing in my dreams. And then our oldest was born, and we sort of went back to a mucusless diet, but we mostly, you know, particularly with a new child, we started eating dairy products and eggs and went to just good old-fashioned vegetarianism. And pretty much stayed that way for the next 40 years. And we just, but you know, it's getting clear to us as we get older that we've got to do something about our bodies. They don't, you know, they don't hang the way they used to, as it were, and fat accumulates a whole lot easier than you want. And so we're just going back to our roots. This is an actual lifestyle. I mean, we went and cleaned out everything from the refrigerator. We got rid of all the bread and all the grains, The only time that we break this diet is Sunday nights when we eat Ethiopian, and if we're at a business dinner and there's no other option. But we're getting pretty good about it. It's back to it feels like I'm a kid again. You know? So
well,
I respect the fast diet. I just don't have the I just don't have the self discipline. Pardon me.
Well,
you,
Dr. Michael Mosley is only doing it one day a week now instead of two.
Oh, interesting.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
See, I found when I was, I mean, we ended up roughly doing it about one day a week, really rigorously doing it. And then the second day, you know, by midnight as we were falling asleep, we had Louise, we were like, let's get a piece of toast. And it didn't seem to be having the effect it should. Thanks, Jim. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, I want to share another thing with you from Cracking the Code. I find this stuff so cool. And then after the break at the bottom of the hour, I will pick up your phone calls, I promise. But I love this stuff, and I think that it's important for people to know. And I wrote this book on NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, only I put it in the context of politics. It's called Cracking the Code: How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. And I'm going back to this, and I'm going back to some of my other books throughout the summer. I've written almost all these books on the air in collaboration with you all. And I do it because I want this information to get out. I believe it's important. And it's been a long time since we talked about this. So one of the most effective ways to talk to or communicate with another person is to do so using the language or the system in which they perceive the world. The way that they understand the world. How does your friend, partner, companion, husband, wife, whatever, child, how do they understand the world? And here's the deal that most people don't realize and never even think about. We all, in very subtle ways, perceive the world differently, but in gross ways, in larger ways, there are some primary categories. About 60-70% of Americans perceive the world primarily visually. They see things. This is the principal way that they know things, and it's the principal way that they remember things. They create visual pictures. They live in a world of color and light and shapes. And you can identify these people by the way they talk. When they're hanging up the phone, they can't even see you. They say, "I'll see you later." Or when they're trying to make sure that you understand what they're saying, they'll say, "Do you see what I mean?" Because they see it. They're visualizing it. So that's the majority of Americans. A significant minority of Americans, around 20-30%, are primarily auditory. That's me, by the way. I'm in that category. My wife, Louise, she's highly visual. Now, these are not exclusive categories. Louise's primary is visual, her secondary is auditory, her third is kinesthetic. My primary is auditory, my second is kinesthetic, my third is visual. I mean, you know, we all have, other ways. We've got a multiple of ways to experience the world. But auditory people experience the world as sound. They can understand 100 subtle gradations in how something sounds. Whereas a visual person wouldn't even notice it. What, he's pausing between his words? There's a change in his tone of voice? Visual person would literally not notice it. But if I'm waving my hand around, they would notice that. Visual people look at people's expressions. Auditory people listen to the tonality of their voice. Auditory people represent roughly 20, maybe 30% of the population. And you can tell them, again, by how they talk. They say, "Hey, that sounds great. I hear what you're saying. I'll talk to you later." Right? These are expressions that give away that the person you're talking to is a principally auditory person, or at least in that moment is hanging out in an auditory space. And then there's a very small minority of people, maybe 5%, 10% of Americans, who are principally kinesthetic. And which means kinesthesia is the afferent or the feeling nerves, feeling, you know, sense, touch, right? And the principally kinesthetic people, they feel the world. And this minority that is kinesthetic has a really difficult time in our schools because our schools teach visually and auditorily. Look at this stuff I wrote on the board. Listen to me talking about it. Whereas kinesthetic learners have to do things in order to know them. One of my kids is kinesthetic and had a hell of a time in school until we all figured it out and found a school that was that taught kinesthetically. Kinesthetic people give away their kinesthesia by saying, boy, I can get my arms around that idea. Hey, great to be in touch. I'll catch you later. And things like that. So here's how it gets important with regard to communication. If you're talking to somebody and they're saying, I see what you're saying. Yep, that's clear to me. Yep, oh yeah, that's crystal clear. Oh, sure, I see that just as clear as day. Then if you say to them, well, here's how I hear it, or here's how I feel about it, they are not going to understand what you're saying. So if you want them to understand your communication, use their language. If you're not a visual person, if you're an auditory person and your impulse is to say, great to hear your voice, you want to say, great to see you. If your impulse is to say, yes, I hear what you're saying, I've heard that before, that sounds good to me, instead say, yeah, I see what you're saying. It's funny, Louise and I have these conversations and she'll say, this has literally happened. In fact, it happened just a couple weeks ago. We were walking down Main Street. We were walking from the store home. And she was trying to explain something to me, and she said, do you see what I'm saying? And I said, I heard every word. And, me being auditory. And she says, no, seriously. She thought I was making fun of her. She said, seriously, do you see what I'm saying? And I said, well, I can't visualize it. I don't see what you're saying, but I did hear everything you said, and I think I understand it. And she said, you don't see what I'm saying? And at that point, I got it. That I'm being really obstinate and stupid here. And I said, yes, Louise, I see what you're saying perfectly. And she was like, oh, good. Do you get this? Now, if you're communicating with more than one person, and I try to do this a lot in both my writing and on radio and TV, is you say, I want you to see what I'm saying, hear what I'm saying, and get a good, solid feeling for this issue. In other words, you throw out all three. And that way, people, each one of the categories, people go, oh, me? So here's a little test. This is on page 42 of Cracking the Code. I naturally and easily say things like, I see what you mean, that sounds sensible to me, or I have a good feeling about that. You can tell. These are, trying to elicit what a person is. When you encounter an old friend, you say, it's great to see you again. Great to hear your voice again. I've missed you. Give him a big hug. People say, I have a good eye for decor and color coordination. I have the ability to arrange a stereo and speakers so the music is great. I have a special feeling for my favorite room. Get it?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So your assignment for the weekend is to pay attention to that and to figure out what you are and the people around you are so you can communicate more effectively. We'll be back with your call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And anything goes Friday here. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Tom, I just wanted to point to a YouTube video when Dylan Radigan was on MSNBC, and he was talking to Democrats and Republicans about how to solve our nation's problems. And I wanted to know if you agreed with this, okay, because I hear a lot of callers say, we need to support this Democratic person or this person, but the money in politics, and that's what he talks about in this video. He said that if we don't acknowledge that that is the root of all our problems, then we will never solve anything. So basically, suggesting we could put the Virgin Mary as president of this country, but that she would be corrupted at some point because our Congress, our president is surrounded by Wall Street, by, neocons who like to promote war. So basically, if we look at solving our economic problems, our environmental, whatever it may be, Tom, is that it will never be solved until we as a nation acknowledge that money has to come out of politics, that we have to reverse Citizens United. And I'm wondering, Tom, if you agree with that, because I've been a Democrat my whole life, but it's just, I'm just seeing that despite the fact there are a couple members of Congress who are progressive, but the majority of Democrats, are still you know, promoting policies that are against the middle class, like the TPP.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'd like
the Progressive Caucus, just as a point of record, is either the largest or the second largest caucus in the United States Congress. It's huge. It's like 90 members. But that said, you're absolutely right. And that's why on this program, that's why back in 2002, I published a book called Unequal Protection, which was about, you know, the corruption of America. I predicted Citizens United. We updated the book in 2011 after Citizens United. I've been talking about it on this program since we started this program in 2003. It has been a recurrent theme. It's why Senator Sanders introduced a bill to amend the Constitution to say that money's not speech and that corporations are not people. It's why Sherrod Brown has been supporting that. Why, you know, a lot of good people. Mark Pocan introduced a similar bill into the House of Representatives with I believe Keith Ellison. There are, and frankly, I think that if we can make the movement large enough, and Move to Amend is really at the nexus of this, movetoamend.org. If we can make the movement large enough, then it is going to become a bipartisan movement. Because basically the only people left who support money in politics are the libertarians, because they're being so heavily funded by billionaires like the Koch brothers. But Democrats and Republicans, with the exception of people like Daryl Issa, who's got enough money to self-fund his own election and can do so because of the 1976 Buckley case, the Supreme Court has said that rich people can fund their own elections. But, which seems to make no sense. I didn't think we had kings in America anymore. But in any case, with the exception of people like Daryl Issa, most members of Congress of both parties are not only offended, but really disgusted by the fact that they have to spend half, sometimes more than half, of literally every single day raising money. I mean, if you're in the United States Senate, you wake up every morning knowing that if you don't raise $20,000, $30,000 today, you're not going to be back in office in 6 years. You wake up in the House of Representatives and know if you don't raise $5,000 to $10,000 every single day, you're not going to be reelected in 2 years. And so my experience has been, talking with both Democrats and Republicans, is that with the exception of the very wealthy guys who can fund their own campaigns, or people who are from states where it doesn't much matter. I mean, Bernie is from Vermont. There's only 600,000 people there. He's probably shaken hands with everybody in the state three times, so he doesn't have to take anybody's money. And, you know, just enough to say I'm here. And so he does these events where people give $25, and that's how he funds most of his campaign. But those are the exceptions, not the rule. You're right. The rule is you got to take money from billionaires, you got to take money from industries, you got to take money from corporations, or you've got to take money from unions. And they all have corrupting influence. This was brought to us courtesy of the United States Supreme Court. Politicians have been trying to get money out of politics since the 1880s. The peak attempt was in 1907 with the Tillman Act, passed during the Teddy Roosevelt presidency, that made it a felony. You go to prison for giving money to somebody who is running for political office at the federal level anywhere in the country. And states enacted very similar laws, and then in 73, 74, after the Nixon scandals and Watergate, Congress passed some very, very good and comprehensive legislation to clean up politics, and the Supreme Court blew a hole in it in 77 and 78. And then they came back and they tried again with John McCain and Russ Feingold, very, very conservative Republican, very liberal Democrat, with McCain-Feingold, and the Supreme Court blew a hole in that, too, with Citizens United and McCutcheon. So what we have to do, the enemy here is the Supreme Court, basically. I mean, they're the ones who keep coming up with this doctrine that doesn't exist in the Constitution. It's made up law. It's never been voted into place by any legislator. It's never been signed by any president. In fact, presidents from literally Grover Cleveland in 1787 in his State of the Union address to Barack Obama 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when he called out the Supreme Court for Citizens United, presidents, with almost virtually without exception, maybe with the exception of Reagan, have said this is wrong. But you know, the Supreme Court they're the monarchs in this constitutional monarchy. So the only way around this is to pass a constitutional amendment. And I think that if we can get enough people awake about this, and I think the threshold is 20-25%, that's enough to like really get the ball rolling. We can wake up enough people about what movetoamend.org is doing and a whole bunch of other groups that are part of their coalition. Public Citizen is involved in this and others. Then the politicians will follow. But the people have to lead. So I would get, you know, if this is your issue, Patricia, I would get over to Move to Amend and say, yes, I will. I'll hold meetings in my kitchen or my living room. I will, or I'll attend others because people can do house parties and things. We'll sponsor a democracy school. We'll invite the people from Move to Amend to come into our community. They're running on a real shoestring. I mean, typically they're not just looking for you to bring people to a room to for them to talk, but also for a place to sleep. And but it's an amazing organization. Are you familiar with them?
Yes, I am. I'm actually familiar with them. And that sounds great. I think we have to do this from the ground level because it looks like it's not going to happen from anywhere else. So
yeah.
It has to be we the people. I've always promoted that, a peaceful revolution.
Yep.
Just by informing people.
This is how we got gay rights. It's how we got civil rights. It's how we got women's rights. It's how we ended slavery. I mean, every significant turning point in America. And you know, even ending slavery, people would say, well, you know, we were just reversing the legislature. You know, the Civil War reversed Dred Scott. It was the damn Supreme Court again, you know. So, it's got to drive from the bottom up. Patricia, thank you for the call. And thank you for raising one of the really, really critical issues of our time. And if you don't feel like you can campaign for your local Democrat because they're in the bag with, you know, Walmart or whatever it may be, or Wall Street, then spend that time and effort with Move to Amend or one of the organizations that's part of their coalition, whatever really, really, you know, excites you. Florence in Rainier, Washington. Hey, Florence, what's up?
Hi there. I'm just calling about the how we did with the 1329 initiative to get big money out of politics, continuing on with the story.
Oh, WAMEN.org.
That's right, WAMEN.org. The end, we got 175,000 signatures, which was not enough to make it on the ballot. We had about 1,700 volunteers, so... We did very well, given. I mean, there's one lady
yeah.
got 5,000 signatures. So,
well, next year.
So next year. So, in fact, what we're doing is we're going to go to the Senate and try and get it through the committee. We couldn't get it through last year. So our plan is to turn the Senate Democrat. It was Republican because a man called Tim Sheldon is a turncoat, and he is from the 35th District. And he walked over and caucused with the Republicans to turn the Washington State Senate Republican. So nothing's happened in the last two sessions. We have a lady called Irene Bowling who's running against him in the August the 5th primary, and the ballots are already on people's tables. So we want to encourage people to vote for Irene Bowling. She's very qualified. She's a concert pianist with all sorts of honor degrees. She's a business owner. She literally bought the Bremerton Symphony Orchestra out from a bankruptcy to a solvency. So she's a very qualified lady. And I just wanted to encourage everybody who's in the 35th District to vote for Irene Bowling.
Great. Florence, so you're moving from ballot initiative activism to political activism. I think that's absolutely marvelous. Now, is she running as a Republican against this Republican?
No, she's running as a Democrat. That's why she'll be in the primary against him, because he calls himself Democrat.
He calls himself a Democrat. He just caucuses and votes with the Republicans?
Well, he's been in the position for 22 years.
Right.
He's also been the Mason County Commissioner for 12 years.
Right.
So he's double dipping and is you know,
just one of those guys who's in it for himself.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, vote for Irene Bowling.
Irene Bowling. Okay, if you're in the 33rd congressional district,
the 35th district. Yeah, it encompasses Kitsap County, Mason County, and Thurston County. You know, one of those strange shaped places.
Right. Yeah, they're all strange shaped places these days, Florence.
Yes.
After all this gerrymandering. But you're absolutely right, Florence. Thank you. And I'm sorry we didn't push it over the top. We sure gave it a plug here on this program. I hope that was of some help.
Thanks so much.
And you're welcome. And you know, next time around, give us a call. We will plug it again. And much appreciated. We'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman program. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday. Your calls coming up next. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sophia in Maysville, Kentucky, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Sophia, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great.
I wanted to talk about something that I think it was about a month and a half ago when the FCC was in the news regarding their proposed plans for the Internet.
Right.
Your phones and Internet kept crashing.
Yes.
And you were sort of being tongue-in-cheek about Comcast crashing your system.
Yeah, no, it's our experience. We've had Comcast for a couple of years. They just have, you know, basically crappy service.
Well, I just wanted to, this happened again to us last night, so I thought I'd call in and tell you about it. That same morning, the day you were having those problems, we have AT&T, both from my partner's iPad and from my Mac, early in the day and later in the day, it seemed as if our site crashed and our internet, when we tried to read an article that was controversial about the Boston bombing, our internet just kept crashing. Even though my modem and the Wi-Fi software on my Mac said I had a signal, whenever I tried to log on, I got the server not found page, no matter what page I tried to go to.
Mm.
And when I persisted, when I would finally get back to the article, if I clicked a link on the article to another informational piece regarding the article, finally, when I persisted, they cut my service completely. And I just gave up and went to bed. The next morning, it was turned back on, and I thought, well, it's probably just a glitch. Last night, from another location, my partner's not home at the moment, she tried to read Glenn Greenwald's latest article regarding the NSA from her iPhone, and her Safari kept quitting. Every time she'd try to read it, it just kept quitting. It seems like on devices, the Safari app just quits, and on laptops, they just block service. Now, I know this could be a coincidence, but I thought it was worth mentioning, and I also, it brought to mind a recent interview that Abby Martin did with Anne Mouchon, a former MI5 agent, and she asserts, and I think this is from Snowden's revelations, that GCHQ and NSA is manipulating polls and internet content,
right.
They're artificially redirecting traffic, they're fabricating communications, etc. And she said it in the UK, and I'm sure it's probably true here also, that those elected to serve are aware that there are files on them, and that they're not allowed to see those files, and that if they don't give spy agencies, et cetera, free rein to exercise their powers, as she put it, quote, nasty little stories will start circulating in the media.
Yeah.
Anyway, she says that backdoor surveillance tools have been embedded in things as simple as USB cables since 2008, and that really worries me with implications with regard to elections, because I know it in my little town, even though I insist on a paper ballot, they just scan it in and toss it. Mm. And I just wanted to throw that out. And if you want, I'll link to Abby's interview on your in your chat room or somewhere.
Oh, sure.
If
yeah.
you choose.
Please do so. It's entirely possible. In fact, it's entirely, in my opinion, probable. I my experience has been that typically they fly far enough beneath the radar that they're not an annoyance to people. That giant data center in Utah, they're not building it. It's built. And, in fact, Greenpeace flew a blimp over it last week that had a big sign on the side saying, you are being spied at, you are being spied from here. And it had an arrow pointing straight down. Great picture of it that I saw at DU. This is the kind of thing that our legislature has the power to rein in. And this is another reason why we need to get people elected who are not, you know, beholden to big business, because now big business is in the business of big intelligence. It's pretty bizarre. Sophia, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back 10 minutes from here. Hey, we're 27th. Yep, we are 27th. Oh, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to writer-researcher Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alpha Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the companies that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica, Sirius XM, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RT TV who work on our evening TV program, The Big Picture, the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everybody at Talk Radio News Service, Jay Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and you for supporting our program. Thank you. No, this program is not number 27. We're actually the number one progressive show in America, a progressive radio show in America. But our country is number 27 in terms of the wealth of the middle class. The average member of the middle class in the United States has wealth, that is assets minus liabilities. The net, you know, what if you had to cash out everything, sell your house, take whatever, you know, sell your cars, whatever's left over, right? Your net worth. The average net worth in America, and keep in mind, we got a lot of millionaires and billionaires who are skewing these numbers up. The average net worth in America is $38,000. In Kuwait, it's 40. In Cyprus, it's 40. In Sweden, it's 41. In Germany, it's 42. In Taiwan, it's 45. In the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, it's 47. In Spain, it's 53. In Qatar, it's 57. In the Netherlands, it's $60,000. This is net worth, right? New Zealand, it's 61. In Finland, it's 63. In Norway, it's 74. In France, it's 79. In Canada, it's 81. The Canadians are almost three times richer than we are, and they're middle class. In Austria, it's 81. This is why there's not, you know, our northern border is not secured. There's no need for it. They're rich. We're poor. Maybe they need to build a fence. Switzerland, 81,000. Singapore, 87,000. Iceland, 95,000. United Kingdom, 95,000. This is Great Britain, 115,000. I thought United Kingdom and Great Britain were the same thing. Apparently they're different. Belgium, 115,000. Italy, 119,000. Japan, 123,000. Luxembourg, 153,000. And Australia, $193,000. That's the wealth of the average middle class family in Australia is almost $200,000. The wealth of the average middle class family in the United States is $38,000. Mind-boggling, huh? Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, you wanted to talk about Flight 17?
Yes, sir. First, I want to make a reference to the young lady who called about the money in politics.
Yeah.
I've been saying for years that America...
Whoa! Wayne, you got to call back. Please call back, because I wanted to hear what you had to say, and I just set my hand down on top of the mouse. And I dumped you, and I put on Mark Taylor Canfield. So, Mark, why don't you give us a quick news report while we are hoping that Wayne can call us back? What's up?
Well, another statistic. We are 46th in the world in terms of press freedom, according to Reporters Without Borders with Finland, number one. So that's a little bit of information.
Wow.
But, Tom, believe it or not, the Occupy Wall Street movement is not over. The third annual Occupy National Gathering is happening in Sacramento, July 31st through August 4th, and I'll be giving an online presentation about press freedom and the new media for that conference. There'll also be presentations by the Move to Amend campaign, Code Pink. There'll be a workshop on Jesus as a radical economic activist. There'll be workshops on Native American sovereignty, one on climate change, which is very important to us up here in Washington State, where President Obama just declared a state of an emergency because of the wildfires up here. But there's all sorts of interesting things going on in Sacramento. So I wanted to let folks know that if you can get more information by going to natgat2014.org, that's NATGAT 2014. I'll also be writing about this over my blog at Daily Coast and at Op-Ed News. But I just wanted everyone to know that the Occupy movement has not disappeared. There are a lot of dedicated folks all across the country who are still working to take on issues like student debt, fracking, home foreclosures, and other really important issues.
Yeah,
you're right.
A lot of things have spun out of Occupy, and it's just really great. Mark Taylor Canfield. Thank you, Mark, from Seattle. Greg in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Greg.
How are you? You know, I'm a recent listener, and I'm often pleasantly surprised when I listen to your show. You mentioned a lot of things that I guess I talk about, but not a lot of people do,
thank you.
The Cobra Act.
We have, by the way, Greg, I got to tell you, we just have 1 minute till the end of the show today.
Oh, okay, real quick. So I'm very much in agreement with you about replacing the Israeli troops with international troops. I think that's the quickest way to end the conflict is if everybody recognizes that, you know, Palestinians in Gaza live worse than North Koreans do under the Kims.
Yeah.
And if the international troops are there, I think Hamas firing at international troops would not go over as well. So I think, but how do you get that to happen? How do you get the international community to?
You mobilize international pressure. I think these pictures of children being bombed in UN shelters are starting to genuinely horrify the international community. I think Israel is starting to lose the PR war, which they have always just routinely won. And we'll see. I mean, you know, we'll see. The Israel lobby is very, very powerful in the United States. It's not as powerful in other parts of the world. And if we can get the UN in there, they won't just be dealing with American politicians who are looking at an election and you know, very afraid of AIPAC and company. So time will tell. On the other hand, it would certainly help if Gaza, if Hamas were to say, okay, we accept Israel's right to exist, like the Palestinian Authority did, the PLO did, and become decent partners for peace. They need to go through that IRA transition that the IRA went through and stop, you know, just shooting and start being statesmen and politicians. I realize it's, you know, it's very difficult for them to do that right now. Greg, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening. We will be back Monday. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.